This show is a Hopful Media podcast production.
Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East. The very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.
The history of Persia is intertwined with conquest. It began with conquest when Cyrus, king of a small city called Anshan, set out to build the greatest empire the world had ever seen. In a series of stunning campaigns, he achieved just that, becoming one of the greatest conquerors in history, and basically started Persian history. After all, you don't get the title the Great for nothing. But he wouldn't be the last great Persian conqueror. Other Persian rulers like Darius the Great, Mithridates I, and Ardashir I would go on to become great conquerors on their own, establishing their own great empires and legacies. If you want to hear their story, and the stories of other great conquerors, many of whom are far less famous despite their great achievements, join me, Ramzi Shalah, on my podcast, The Conquerors Podcast, available on all platforms you listen through.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to America's Secret Wars, the podcast about forgotten, overlooked, and deliberately covered up times the United States military has used force to fight or occupy foreign nations. I am your host, Trevor Cully, doing my absolute best to sound chipper about this opening at a time when reading that description really sucks. This is part four of our series on the conflicts that led into the Webster-Ashburton Treaty, and I still have Nick and Bailey with me. How are you two doing?
Oh, so swell.
Yeah, we're recovering from the plague.
Yeah. Which plague? We don't know.
Which one? Take your pick. Maybe a nice melting pot of all of them in one. That's sort of how it feels.
Every day felt different, so.
Yeah, I've gotten nosebleeds for the first time in my life from this, so.
See, this is something I don't understand, because if the humidity drops below, like, a medium percentage, my nose just starts bleeding.
I always knew those kids in school as the nosebleed kids, and I always felt superior because I never got a nosebleed, but I think this illness right now is my karma.
The issue is I have a hard time looking at blood, so every time Nick has a nosebleed, I get lightheaded.
Oh yeah, you fully has to leave the room. It's so funny.
I also work in a place, in a kitchen, so there's a lot of people who cut themselves a lot of the time.
This seems like it's going great for you, Bailey.
Yeah, everyone but me. I don't cut myself because I know where my hand is. Fuck all that. I'm not leaving with bad, ugly-ass hands.
Might I recommend a mandolin? Guaranteed to lose some body parts.
Exposure therapy.
Blood exposure therapy by amputation seems like the right call. I am procrastinating starting this episode. All right, like I said, part four on the Anglo-American border crises of the mid-1800s.
But this time, we're west.
Not quite.
Ah, damn.
This time, oddly enough, we are south.
Oh.
Oh.
Okay.
Okay, Niagara, go off.
It has been a minute since we recorded, so to recap, we have covered the Republic of Indian Stream and its weird little constitution.
Of course. We obviously know all this, so you don't need to recap, but just for the listeners' benefit, obviously.
Yes, yeah, obviously. Not for us at all. Definitely, just for the people who are hearing it 1 week after the last episode, not for us, who haven't met in like a month.
Yeah. I just want everyone to know that this stream of episodes have so far taken about 2 months.
I have recorded with Roberto while we were doing this. So we did Indian stream, then we did the mostly bloodless, and I remind Bailey, mostly bloodless Aroostook war between Maine and New Brunswick.
All right, poor bear.
And then the consider and the guy the bear mauled.
Yeah, he lived. He's fine. You're in a whole constitution after. He's fine.
Then we did the considerably bloodier Patriots War, when the U.S. couldn't quite decide if we were going to invade Canada or help capture Canadian rebels.
Well, the options are just limitless.
So how are we doing so far with the U.S. invading or not invading Canada thing?
Well, the borders hasn't changed all three times, so...
There is this, I don't know if Americans know about this, but there's this, like, thing happening right now where every Canadian grocery store, the items that are Canadian and, like, made here, produced here, sold here, are labeled as Canadian-owned, and then the American items are labeled as such, because everybody is like, we can only buy Canadian. Fuck everyone from America. And I don't think anyone from the States knows that this is happening.
Oh my
even
God.
A little bit. We're having a one-sided beef right now.
If you go to liquor stores, all the places where American alcohol was, there is now a sign saying go buy Canadian.
Look, your whiskey is nice, but I will give the U.S. credit for about three things in history, and whiskey, we come in like third place.
We make cheap knockoffs, it's fine.
But it's just like this whole, and at hockey games, they're booing every American team. Whenever the American national anthem comes on, Canadians are booing. And like, it's like all of Canada is like, fuck America right now. And all of America is like, I'm not even conscious that this is going on.
I've never seen our political parties so aligned.
Look, you should boo the American national anthem anyway, because it's a shitty song.
Agreed. Agreed. As a musicologist, worst anthem.
Yeah. And I can't wait till we rank world anthems in our new series, Totalis Anthemionis.
Ranking all of the national anthems from Armenia to Zimbabwe.
Yeah.
Exactly. This week, Bosnia.
starting a civil war with your podcast. All right. Mercifully, given current events, every episode in this series has ended more or less in the same place with the Webster-Ashburton Treaty of 1842. Yeah. So far, we have covered most of that treaty. A lot of it was about border disputes, which we talked about in the first two episodes. Some of it was about extraditions and establishing the Caroline Test, which we covered last time. Today, we are mostly going to leave Canada behind for a minute to deal with the last major issue of Daniel Webster and Lord Ashburton's treaty. And this one isn't nearly as militant as any of the episodes so far, but it felt weird to not include this because we've covered the entire rest of the treaty. And originally, when I realized this was becoming a series, I thought I was going to smash this bit onto the end of the Indian stream episode, just because it was short and wasn't going to be enough for its own episode. And then I looked at what year we were talking about and realized there was a problem.
Oh.
We are talking about the United States before the year 1865,
which...
And one bloody political debate has been conspicuously absent this entire time.
Yes. Can you wear different colored socks on different feet?
No, that's a shooting crime.
Oh, okay.
Well, shit. Yeah, that you get the wall.
It's okay. I'm wearing Santa socks right now on both feet.
My socks match. I'll have you know.
We don't post the video for this, but Bailey is making the poor choice to show feet to the camera.
For free? For free.
This is the exclusive. This is what you get.
We have to have a Totalis Jeffianus marketing talk right now.
Yeah, and when this episode is posted, there will be a picture of my feet as well.
if you join my membership at the $100 tier, I will post Bailey's feet pics. unfortunately, feet pics is not the problem we are discussing today. Do you have any secondary guesses?
Slavery, maybe?
Yeah, slavery. The answer is slavery.
Damn, it's always the second worst option.
Which is why I brought this. I'm currently holding up a beer bottle the size of my skull.
Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds great.
Because the Webster-Ashburton Treaty is actually the agreement where the United States finally agreed to outlaw the international slave trade.
Great.
But getting to that point...
Hell yeah.
Getting to that point was one of the main issues that almost drove the U.S. and Britain to war, even after negotiations had already started.
America just didn't know if slavery was bad or not yet. They needed a few minutes to decide.
They had to think about it. They had to ruminate.
Yeah, this is the part where I point out that the first Western abolitionist that I have found in history was in 500 CE. So anybody making the, well, it was just the way it was at the time, can shove it up their ass.
I hate that argument.
There were a lot of abolitionists by this point.
There's also a lot of Black people in the country who, for some reason, are not counted when asked that question. Like, maybe we talk to the majority of the population in slavery, and maybe that's the majority of the population. They don't agree with slavery.
It sounds like so anti-American propaganda.
Sorry.
Where is John Brown? we'll do that episode. Unsurprisingly, the U.S. had a lot going on vis-a-vis the question of slavery at this time, because it was basically always the number two or three issue in American politics from the time we declared independence, and it was rapidly approaching the number one topic of debate by the beginning of the 1840s.
Yeah, John Quincy Adams would shut the hell up in the freaking Senate chambers about it.
Yeah, it's written into the rules for distributing electoral votes in our constitution. It is literally baked into the system.
Yeah. What is it? Slaves are worth 3/5 of a white person.
And I get why that sounds really shitty, but I do feel obliged whenever that comes up to point out that the 3/5 compromise was in fact a compromise to decrease the power of the slavers who wanted to count slaves as
full person
people, because it would, but they couldn't vote, so it would give the white minority in the South more power in Congress.
It's just like a really horrible moment that I wish everyone could bask in as it's happening.
counting enslaved people as less than a full person was actually the positive option.
It's like, now that whenever I see those stupid like Facebook like the top 10 weirdest laws, I can't look at them and not think about Jim Crow anymore. And it's like, oh, this actually isn't funny. This actually isn't funny that you're not allowed to be loud in a park after 6 p.m. in this state. That's actually a way that we're criminalizing being a minority.
Yeah, there's the ones like that that are funny are the ones that are oddly specific in a way. It's like,
oh, somebody fucked this up.
So I'm not going to rehash the entire legal history of slavery in the United States here. And I'm not going to do that because it would take about its own 1,000 episode series. And quite frankly, the U.S. has never shut up long enough to let anybody in the world forget that we had slavery in our history, except for ourselves. So
funny how that works.
The War of Northern Aggression. We'll light Georgia on fire again someday, I'm sure. Britain, on the other hand, had outlawed the slave trade within their empire in 18-fucking-07. and they had outlawed the institution of slavery itself for the entire empire in 1833, just before this whole almost war situation in the Americas kicked off.
Okay.
Now,
so not ideal for America.
No. You know, how could they have known it was such a debate? Well, the English did it. Now, this does come with the caveat that this mostly worked out for Britain because they had India, an entire subcontinent of 150 million people at this point, who could all, they could all sort of be treated like the U.S. treated enslaved black people. For comparison, the United Province of Canada in 1840 had a total population of barely a million, and the entire U.S., including enslaved people, was 17 million.
Yeah, I think we're about that same proximity now. Because what, we got like 40 million and America's got like 380 million?
Yeah, something like that.
How do you have that in your head? I just Googled it and that's right. Why do you know that?
I don't know.
Yeah, but comparing population figures to China and India is frankly sort of cheating.
Unfair. Yeah.
Despite continuing British racism, the fact that they were in the process of abolishing slavery this early on is an example of why you can beat the shit out of people who think we shouldn't judge Americans in this time period.
Yeah.
Yeah, I hate the arguments.
It's okay to punch Nazis.
Even when they're on stage behind very impressive looking podiums or inside of shitty cars. I'm not talking about any Nazis in particular here, but those are acceptable times to punch Nazis.
Yeah, if you made connections, that's on you.
Look up the German-American Bund in Madison Square Garden. Just a thing for everybody to Google. Following the British abolition of the slave trade, they had the Napoleonic Wars, and the British actually used all the upheaval in Europe to kind of force everyone else into line with abolitionism. Almost every country in Europe signed treaties that included an obligation to outlaw the slave trade.
Yep. Great moment in history.
In 1807, same year as the British abolition of the trade, the United States had outlawed the importation of new enslaved Africans. Legally, this brought an end to the triangle trade, the almost 200-year-old system of merchants exchanging enslaved people for raw produce in the southern U.S. or the Caribbean, then exchanging raw materials for finished goods in the northeastern U.S. or Europe. This did not stop the illegal smuggling of human chattel, but officially, Americans were limited to something called the coastwise trade, a system wherein enslaved people could still be transported by ship and sold elsewhere, but they had to stay near the United States' territorial waters. Initially, abolitionists considered this a win. In the early decades of American independence, there was a pretty widespread belief that the United States would eventually just grow out of slavery, despite the protest of the Southern plantation class.
Oh, grow out of it?
Yeah, why don't you guys just grow up? Stop selling slaves.
So, on one hand, that seems incredibly stupid in hindsight, because it is. On the other hand, I can see why they might look at it and go, well, you know, in ancient times, there were these massive slave states, and eventually, as time went on, that fell away. And we brought it back because we were growing it in a different capacity, and eventually that will fall away. What they've kind of failed to realize is that Rome had to be killed for slavery to fall out as an institution, and they replaced it with serfdom.
Yeah, and it also took, like, it was a long, drawn-out process that...
It took, like, 1,000 years.
Oh, yeah. In some places, 2,000 years. Insane.
You know, the Romans had slavery, and eventually the French abolished it in the 1300s. And then they had colonies.
Arose by any other name, something, something.
Yeah, right. Over the decades, more and more states abolished slavery in the more industrialized North, and prohibitions were put in place to prevent too many new states from entering the Union with slavery. We talked a little bit about Maine becoming a state in the Aroostook War episode.
Right.
That was the counterweight to Missouri becoming a slave state at the same time. Maine right. was free from the beginning.
Right.
So, like, this is what they thought would slowly phase out slavery in the U.S. Mm.
Doing nothing in half the country and doing something in the other half.
Yeah. What they failed to realize is that instead the total number of slaves in the United States continued to grow because the Southern owners would force people to reproduce and steal their children.
Yeah, and also it would inspire the entire Underground Railroad too, that was going on at this point, but it made it larger because all they knew is that if we get up there, we're free.
Yeah, well, speaking of that, banning importation did next to nothing to actually slow down the expansion of chattel slavery. The population continued to grow, and there was a constant battle between abolitionists and slavers in Congress and state legislatures over what would happen to enslaved people who self-emancipated and fled to the free states. Especially after British abolition, the Underground Railroad of free Black Americans and abolitionists worked hard to help people reach Canada and escape Southern bounty hunters. By 1840, almost 12,000 formerly enslaved people had found refuge over the northern border. The early 1840s saw a very complicated pair of events play out that once again managed to put the U.S. on both sides of its own dispute with the British Empire. The main one that we will be talking about today is the so-called Creole case. Have either of you ever heard of that one?
I think I have. It definitely rings a bell.
I don't know.
So the Creole is kind of the last in a series of enslaved uprisings at sea that contributed to animosity between Britain and the U.S. in the 1830s and 40s.
I think this is something I know about this because, like, when I did my, like, jazz history studies, we did, like, a very brief overview of why jazz started in the States, and it started with slave song and, like, work song and that kind of thing. So, yeah.
The Creole in particular became kind of an early piece of Black popular culture in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So that's not surprising to me. But it's not a particularly well-known thing today in the grand scheme of slave uprisings, even. It's pretty minor. But it is the thing that factored most directly into the Webster-Ashburton negotiations.
Right.
However, I was researching that and reading through things, and then I was looking at the date and realized it would be downright irresponsible of me not to address another legal battle playing out in the U.S. at the same time. So you haven't really heard anything about the Creole.
No.
But what about another ship named La Amistad?
No.
Interesting.
Yeah, no, not at all.
If I switch the article to English and make it the Amistad, does it ring any more bells?
I don't think so.
I definitely heard it from somewhere.
Well, it is an award-winning Steven Spielberg film from 1997 with one of the most impressive cast lists you will ever see. And most disturbing setting and quantity of penises I've ever seen on screen at once.
Bailey, write that
down.
Sounds
like, yeah, sounds like my kind of movie.
I said it was disturbing. The Amistad was an illegal Spanish slave trading ship that wound up at the center of a seminal U.S. Supreme Court case that is stupid and enraging in equal measure.
Great. I'm so excited.
And I think it's important that we talk about it first, if only to fully understand, A, the context of the slave trade in the United States at the time, and the bottomless depths of American hypocrisy.
I already knew how bottomless it was, but
this is why I'm drinking.
I like, yeah. Part of me is thinking like, oh, well, we only don't know this because we're Canadian. And I think like my knowledge of like American Black history is probably more extensive than most just because I have studied jazz so much. And but then I realized that y'all are probably also not taught this in America.
Oh yeah, we watched the movie in my 7th grade English class because my school did a very intelligent thing and kind of distributed the history curriculum through a couple of different subjects to give more important topics more breathing room. But it was really controversial to be teaching us about this in particular.
Yeah, grade seven.
Not, yeah, that's when we did it.
I remember like we talked about like the Underground Railroad specifically, and I think like we read a book about it in probably 5th grade. Grade 5 is when I remember
Yeah, maybe grade 6 or 7 for me.
the most we ever really touched on it.
Yeah, and I'll be honest, I think largely is because when Britain abolished slavery, that also included Canada. So when Canada became a country, slaves had already been abolished for 20, 30, 40 years. So
Yeah, well, the slave trade had been abolished for almost 40 years, and slavery itself was out a decade before most of what we've been talking about, which is also kind of Canada's origin story. But yeah, so it's not surprising to me that you don't cover a ton of American slavery. Also, just it's cold up there, not a lot of great land for plantations.
Yeah. Which doesn't feel like a great reason, but at least it's something.
No. But yeah, it was never going to be the same population disparity as like the Caribbean islands.
Well, even like just look at it in history. The more north you go, the less slavery there is.
Tell that to the Vikings and the Russian serfs.
There are not that, a lot of outliers.
We've now hit the Arctic Circle, and there still seems to be a shitload of So, sometime around 1838 or early 1839, a human smuggling operation, illegal under international law, landed in Mendeland, which is now part of Sierra Leone.
Great.
The Mende people are very interesting in their own right, and some of their specific beliefs and traditions came up as part of these events. But seeing as this is already a tangent within this episode, we really do not have time to get into that. I do recommend everybody looking up the Mende too, though. They are a really interesting culture. Anyway. At least 53 Mende people, including 4 children, were captured by local African slavers, either other Mende or one of the many other groups in the region. I say at least because any captives who were sold separately from that 53 that we know about most are mostly lost to the horrors of history. These captives were then sold to Portuguese human smugglers operating in Africa and transported to Cuba. Once there, they were purchased by the Spanish merchant Ramon Ferrer and loaded onto his ship, the Amistad.
See, and you also hear a lot of arguments which come mostly from the far right, where it's like, yeah, but like what people don't want to tell you is like African people were selling each other into slavery. Like, no one ever mentions black people selling other black people into slavery. So, like, and I'm like, okay, what are you trying to say, buddy?
Yeah, and I've literally never met someone who does not bring that up. Literally never had a conversation or a lecture about this topic where somebody doesn't point that out.
And it's just like such a bad argument.
I have had literal African American communists explain this to me, and they bring that up. I don't know what the hell the right wing is talking about. So the Amistad departed Havana and were bound or was bound for the small town of Guahana. The Amistad itself was not a slave ship, just a merchant schooner. Even if that word means nothing to you, you've definitely seen pictures of this type of old-timey ship. They are the kind that sit very low in the water with two kind of overlapping triangle sails in the front and two bigger rectangle sails in the back.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Most importantly, compared to purpose-built slave ships, a schooner like the Amistad wasn't designed to carry tons of people, even in poor conditions. So half of the Mende were put in the cargo hold, while the others were kept on the main deck. Since they were supervised, the Mende on deck had much more freedom of movement than the enslaved people at sea typically enjoyed. This gave them a bit more leeway in planning amongst themselves, and somebody below decks found an old rusty file left behind with some previous cargo. They started sawing through their chains. Very fortunately for the Mende captives, they weren't the only cargo on board. There was also some sugar cane and sugar processing tools.
Makes sense.
Now, if you've ever seen sugarcane harvesting, even today, you know where this is going. Sugarcane is processed with big fuck-off knives that look sort of like short-bladed machetes.
Yeah.
So once the Mende had broken out of their chains, they grabbed the cane knives and mutinied. Ramon Ferrer and most of the white crew were killed, as were two of the captives.
Wait, to mutiny, wouldn't you need to have any sort of respect for the people in the first place?
Yeah, it is the word that is used for rebellions at sea more generally, but I agree.
It's like, yeah, we're gonna revolt against this guy. We're gonna betray him.
Yeah. It is a slave revolt. It just happens to be on a boat.
Mutiny, I guess. Best word for what happens on boats.
It's like how we have robbery for everything else, unless it's at sea, and then you're a pirate.
Right.
Yeah.
Which is objectively cooler.
Yeah, just wait until...
Can I rob something and they call me a pirate, please?
The internet. If you steal on the internet, you're also a pirate.
You wouldn't download a boat.
Abso-fucking-lutely I would. That is my favorite ad of all time, because download a car. So two of the whites were kept alive to help pilot the ship back to Africa. There were just two problems. One, the Amistad would have struggled to cross the Atlantic with an entirely willing and capable crew. And two, these white guys were hostages who firmly believed that they owned their captors. So they gave the Mende bad directions. And yeah. Overnight, they redirected the ship to sail north toward the United States.
I feel like I could have called that one. I saw that one coming.
You know, when you go through the history of similar revolts at sea like this, that does seem like the obvious thing. And this is sort of stuff keeps happening over and over again. Like, there's a revolt. You're going to take us home. And they're like, yeah, where is the nearest prison?
Yeah, it's just crazy, because it's like, these guys, if they realize at any point during this journey that you're leading them to their deaths, you're done. And like, it's not going to be fast.
No, they are going to kill you slowly and brutally with really big knives.
Yeah.
And while this is a terrible time, there's not a good time in this episode, because it's about terrible things. So yeah. Hopefully you get an ad for really big knives.
Woo! Yeah.
Gamarjoba. My name is Roberto, and I would like to sincerely thank you for taking the time to check out my podcast, The History of Sakartvelo, Georgia. In all likelihood, I would venture to guess that you found us because you were searching for either podcasts, YouTube videos, blogs about the history of Georgia, or you're hearing this on another podcast, like this one. I'm both sorry and happy to report that this beautiful and fascinating country is, to my great surprise, criminally underrated in the history world. As of now, this is the only podcast I am aware of dedicated to the full history of a nation and a people that have served as the battleground for empires all throughout European and Asian history. But the land of the Kartveli is so much more than that. The birthplace of wine, the second Christian kingdom, the land of fantastic food, nearly superhuman dancers and musicians, and perhaps, most importantly, a people that have preserved their culture, pride, and independence after centuries of one conquest after another. Empires rise and fall, but Sakartvelo always seems to survive in the end. So, let us celebrate this beautiful land by coming with me on this journey from prehistory to the present day, right here at the History of Sakartvelo, Georgia. You can find us on Twitter at @history_Georgia. Sakartvelo is spelled Sakartvelo. Now back to your regularly scheduled podcast.
Hello, everybody. This is Trevor Cully, host of the History of Persia podcast. From about 550 to 330 BC, most of the Middle East was ruled by the Achaemenid Persians. The Achaemenids pioneered the concept of a truly multinational empire, which incorporated people from as far away as India and Greece for over 200 years. The story of Persia discusses the fall of ancient civilizations, the origins of endurance racing, 300 Spartans, the March of the 10,000, and at least one evil priest who replaced and impersonated the king, all before falling with the dramatic close at Alexander the Great's conquests. If that story and the story of the cultures that surround it sound interesting to you, check out The History of Persia at historyofpersiapodcast.com or wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
Hi, all. If you enjoy this podcast, you might also enjoy Alexandria, a Hellenistic world. The Hellenistic period is famous for its epic battles and backstabbing royal families. But for every king or general, there were thousands of other stories. Bureaucrats like Zenon the estate manager, or soldiers like Pyrrhicus, a cavalry officer who terrorized the very village he was tasked to protect. Or just regular people. People you never hear about anywhere else, but you should. Like Tessicles, an old mother wronged by her daughter who moved to the big city, or Eliphion, a prostitute who fell in love with one of her clients. These were real people. These are their stories. Join me as we travel to Alexandria, a Hellenistic world.
Speaking of talking about terrible shit, it's not particularly clear if the white navigators overshot, were expecting to be intercepted sooner, or just misunderstood American politics.
I'm guessing the story changed depending on who asked it.
Well, by late August, they reached Long Island, New York. The first few civilian boats to find them supplied food and water to relieve everyone on board the Amistad. But when a white boat captain tried to send someone aboard to guide the Amistad through Long Island Sound, the Mende shot at him. They were like, you're not putting another white guy on this boat.
Yeah, you know, fair reaction.
And that seems reasonable to me.
But like, I can't say I wouldn't have done the same if I were.
So the Amistad, they remained there for a few more days before the USS Washington, a Navy ship, found them and pointed a bunch of cannons at the Amistad until they willingly came into New Haven, Connecticut. The Amistad's arrival in Connecticut promptly set off a legal clusterfuck. Spain was furious that its ship and citizens were being detained, also that a bunch of their citizens had been murdered. President Martin Van Buren said, paraphrasing, "You're right, but I'm not a king, so I can't just order their release. In fact, I really have no say in the judicial system at all." Ah, to live in a world where the president didn't have a role in the judicial system.
Poor Martin Van Buren, though.
American history's greatest punching bag.
I feel so bad for him.
The two white navigators claimed that the Mende had been born in Cuba and were being legally transported within the Spanish Empire before the mutiny. Which might have been a better argument if any of them spoke Spanish.
Great.
Oh, you know, the one, I assume they spoke Mende, my guess. Mm-hmm. The Mende section of Cuba, you've been there. You know about it.
Well, like, why don't they just go to the Mende, like, national building? You know how everyone has, like, a building in their, for each country?
The Mende consulate.
They should have just went there.
Weird thing about consulates in the 1800s. And it's like that skin color graph from Family Guy. Instead, some formerly enslaved people in Connecticut were found who knew a bit of Mende, and they came to interpret, which led to a very different story than the one the Cubans were selling.
Crazy.
Yeah, real shocker. I do imagine somebody just running from the courthouse, trying to, like, grabbing random black people all over New Haven and being like, I need you to come with me and tell me if you know this language.
Which is probably not an inaccurate description of what happened.
I am sure that's how it worked.
Yeah.
Like, or, you know, going to, like, one or two of the prominent black people and being like, do you know anybody who might know?
I'm not talking about how there's over, like, 100,000 different dialects in Africa alone.
Like, we're pretty sure it's African, but frankly, it could be something from South America. We're not sure. So the Cubans were also telling a different story than the Spanish government, which claimed that the Mende captives were legal property of the Spanish crown, while still more Spaniards claimed that they had nothing to do with the Mende, but they did have a legal right to the cargo, like the sugar cane and stuff.
Oh. Okay.
So they didn't count the Mende as the cargo.
Yeah, not for these purposes, not for, like, their insurance claims.
Right.
They were like, look, I don't know what the deal is with this slavery stuff, but, like, sugar. They did steal my knives.
The slavery car salesman back then must have been.
This ship can fit so many crimes against humanity in it. So the Navy lieutenant in charge of the USS Washington tried to claim both the Amistad and the Mende as his property through salvage rights. The civilian captains who first found the Amistad did the same. And of course, the Mende themselves were arguing that they were not slaves and had been kidnapped from their homeland.
What? That doesn't sound right.
The British consul in Washington, D.C. got involved too, arguing aggressively in favor of the Mende in order to enforce Britain's abolitionist hegemony on the high seas, and to enforce their own treaty with Spain, which forbids Spain from doing this kind of shit.
Yeah.
I said it was a legal clusterfuck.
I'm sure some of the lawyers I work with have something to say about this.
This is like a four-country deal going on right now.
There are three countries, a Spanish colony, and like eight interested parties, not including the Mende themselves.
Who, by the way, it should be said, are probably extremely interested parties.
Yeah, are kind of maybe the only party that should count. Americans rallied to get legal representation for the Mende, with one of the former captives named Sengbe Pia becoming the unofficial spokesman for his fellow prisoners. Because of some quirks in international law and pre-existing treaties, the United States government had to provide legal representation for the nation of Spain in court.
So this is three countries all going at it, but all three of those countries are being represented by the United States.
So the British are just pressuring and lobbying the U.S. government. Spain is suing the United States government, but because of some legalese, they have an American public defender, basically.
And is this at the time where it was, like, because I know for a little bit it became illegal to talk about slavery, and I think that was under Martin Van Buren, wasn't it? So I
think it might have been later.
Okay.
Like, and it was just banned from, like, the White House and the congressional floor for a little bit.
Yeah.
and didn't work out particularly well because they like beat the shit out of each other instead.
Well, and then also, like, I think, again, John Quincy Adams then would mention it, and then they'd put him on trial, and he'd be like, okay, great, I'm on trial. Then he would spend his entire time on trial talking about how bad slavery was.
Yeah. Yeah. Just hang on to that one. Things proceeded by the book, starting in the local circuit court in New Haven, but the case was passed up the chain pretty quickly. Between any crime occurring vaguely at sea and all of the international interests involved, it was the sort of case that could really only be adjudicated by the U.S. Supreme Court. And it was one hell of a trial.
I can only imagine. Oh, is that part of the movie?
Oh, yeah. That's most of the movie. The United States Attorney General, Henry Gilpin, represented Spain opposite former president and sitting member of the House of Representatives, John Quincy Adams, representing the Mende in the case of United States versus the Amistad.
I'll be honest, it's kind of like, I don't know, John Quincy Adams is my favorite president, as it not for his presidency, but for his life and for what he's like did for slavery in America and how he kind of really put the groundwork into eventually the war and everything. But
I don't have a favorite president because I'm morally pure.
Look, the best American president is William Henry Harrison.
Nick, the joke is he died 28 days into his presidency.
I knew that. Okay. I knew that.
The U.S. versus Amistad was a heavily publicized and publicly debated case. And one judge actually died during the process.
Stressful job.
Maybe were they just also still old as fuck?
I mean, yeah, always.
Well, he was only, this one in particular was only 23, weirdly, but.
they made special dispensation to get him through below the minimum age. And he immediately turned 82. But one of them dying during the case was actually like potentially dangerous because it created an even number of justices that could lead to a strong court. SCOTUS ultimately came down on the side of the Mende in a gargantuan 7-1 decision that not only recognized the Mende captives as illegal hostages with a right to freedom, but also upheld their right to seize control of the Amistad, ruling that when the ship entered American waters, the former prisoners were actually the ship's rightful owners.
Slay.
See, and John Quincy Adams was a great lawyer. Let that be said.
The Mende and their legal representatives, including former President Adams, arranged to sell the Amistad in order to cover their cost of living in the U.S. for a few more months before they were given a ride back to Mendeland.
Is this after his presidency?
Yes.
See, in my head, after you're president, there's nothing left after you're done. Like, you can't go back to work.
Like, him particular, he is an outlying case. There's not many presidents that do.
I was going to say, like, what is Obama doing? He is not in the courtroom.
hanging out with Oprah and making increasingly bad looks.
Yeah.
But no, it's really, I think it's really just Quincy Adams and Taft who go on to have, like, political careers after their time in office.
Andrew Johnson started to have a comeback before he died.
We hate that guy, right?
Yes, we do. But he was ramping up to run again, and then he died.
And you know what? They should have impeached his ass, but I'll talk about that some other time. The fact that they didn't impeach him is the reason America has never impeached another president. If they had just done it and gotten it out of the way, it wouldn't be such a big deal.
I think the last thing I'll say about it, too, is Totalis Rankia made a great little like image of it where you could see John Quincy Adams like dining with an old Washington. And then when he died on the Senate floor, you could see a horrified Abraham Lincoln watching him die.
Mm-hmm.
And he's kind of the connection between Washington and Lincoln.
John Quincy Adams is one of the more interesting figures in like post-revolutionary American politics. So all of this was going on between 1839 and 1842. with the U.S. coming down on the British side of abolitionism. But don't worry, everything still sucks.
Great.
President Van Buren was furious about this decision. He was terrified that this would upset U.S. relations with Spain at a moment when war with Britain over the Canadian border was looking more and more likely.
You don't want a two-front war.
Well, and more importantly, you wanted Spain as an ally still. Yeah. They hadn't quite become the desiccated corpse of an empire that we would fight a couple decades later. He was also worried that the Amistad case would spark more conflict between American slavers and abolitionists. Spoiler alert for Marty, but I don't think the court case was the problem. How fucking ever. Don't let this mislead you into thinking that the U.S. was leaning any more abolitionist than usual at the time.
Yeah.
It took the biggest name in the abolitionist party to even get this through.
Yes, absolutely. And even then, like, it mostly happened because there was not a good argument to be had on the other side.
Yeah.
In the minds of white abolitionists and slavers alike, there was a massive legal distinction between illegally enslaved in Africa by the Portuguese and totally fine because they were born into slavery right here in the US of A.
Great.
Which brings me to the case of another slave ship mutiny, the Creole.
Okay.
Yes.
Part two. And this one's going to go even better.
Correct. And while we are here, I will throw in the second ad break because this is as best a transition as I'm going to get.
Hello and bonjour. My name is Josh Zucker, and I want to take you on a journey through some of the most exciting events of the late Middle Ages. Valois Burgundy was one of the medieval world's greatest what-ifs. Its dukes inherited, conquered, and politicked their way into forging a state between the German Empire and the Kingdom of France that rivaled them both. From the Hundred Years' War to the Holy Roman Empire, from urban workers to Joan of Arc, and from gallant knights to gunpowder weapons, the Grand Dukes of the West had a part to play in almost all of Western Europe's biggest developments in the 14th and 15th centuries. If you want to learn more about the glamorous rise and dramatic fall of the Dukes of Burgundy, please join me for Grand Dukes of the West, A History of Valois Burgundy.
Hello, comrades, and welcome to the podcast you are currently listening to. I promise, this isn't a Russian invasion, it's a temporary occupation. I'm Roberto, one of the hosts of the podcast, Tsar Power.
And I'm Aurora, the other half of the podcast. Together, we're ranking the Russian rulers from Rurik to Putin. They will compete based on how well they fought, how successful they were in life, how much blackmail they had on them, how they look, how they died, and how long they ruled for.
After being scored, we decide whether they get to party it out in the Kremlin, because there is no party like the Communist Party, or get sent straight to the Gulag. Those who make it to the Kremlin will need to dance it out for the position of the best Russian ruler in our hit show, Dancing with the Tsars. You can find us on any podcast host as Tsar Power, and on Twitter at Tsar Power Pod, and on Facebook at Tsar Power. Our website's also tsarpower.com. That's Tsar spelled T-S-A-R.
Now back to your regularly scheduled podcast, and if you hear a knock at the door, beware, KGB is coming to make your stay a bit more permanent.
Hi, all. If you enjoy this podcast, you might also enjoy Alexandria, a Hellenistic world. The Hellenistic period is famous for its epic battles and backstabbing royal families. But for every king or general, there were thousands of other stories. Bureaucrats like Zenon the estate manager, or soldiers like Pyrrhicus, a cavalry officer who terrorized the very village he was tasked to protect. Or just regular people. People you never hear about anywhere else, but you should. Like Tessicles, an old mother wronged by her daughter who moved to the big city, or Eliphion, a prostitute who fell in love with one of her clients. These were real people. These are their stories. Join me as we travel to Alexandria, a Hellenistic world.
So let's set the scene. It is Halloween 1841.
Ooh, spooky.
The Webster-Ashburton negotiations are just starting to address tensions between the U.S. and Britain.
Can I imagine everyone in these scenes in, like, full Halloween costumes?
Yes, absolutely.
There's a banana and a hot dog. One wants slaves.
until we get to the next day, then everybody has to, I guess, be dressed as pilgrims? I don't know.
Really hungover.
Yes, definitely. The United States versus the Amistad has just ruled in favor of illegally enslaved Mende people. Mm. And 135 enslaved Black people were just loaded onto a ship called the Creole in Richmond, Virginia, to be transported and sold at auction in New Orleans.
Right.
Legally speaking, this was entirely fine with the United States government, since the Creole was engaged in the domestic coastwise trade. One of the enslaved men on board was Madison Washington.
Ooh, I recognize that.
He was a man with a very curious backstory. In 1839, he had actually self-emancipated and fled Virginia with help from abolitionists involved in the Underground Railroad. One stop on Madison's journey was Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and he was actually there during the Amistad case. The abolitionist who housed Madison at the time later wrote about how he seemed fascinated by a portrait of Sangbe Pia published alongside newspaper coverage of the Amistad, a story that Madison himself would commit to memory.
Wow.
By the end of that year, Madison Washington reached Canada, joining approximately 12,000 Black refugees who had fled from American slavery. But Madison's wife was still enslaved in Virginia. Desperate, he returned to the slaving South to find her and was captured, re-enslaved, and loaded onto the Creole to be sold far away.
I have heard the story. Absolutely.
I have not.
It is an interesting one. Well, Madison remembered that news story about the Mende slaves who took over their ship, and he knew that with 135 captives in the hold of the Creole, there were only 14 white people on board. So he conspired with 18 of his fellow prisoners, and when one of the white crewmen lifted the metal grate between the hold and the upper deck, they struck. They grabbed the guy opening the gate, snuck out of the cargo hold, stole a knife, killed one of the slave traders, and detained the rest of the crew.
Good. Good night.
As it turned out, the slavers only even had a single gun on board and nobody ever fired it. But of course, the 18 rebels had no way of knowing before charging their captors completely unarmed.
Yeah.
One of them even died after fighting with the crew hand to hand. On a funnier note, the captain and two of the crew wound up trapped after climbing the ship's rigging in an attempt to escape the violence on the main deck.
Where are you going, dude? Where are they going to go?
just climbing up into the air.
Just going up. I'll fly away.
So as Madison Washington and his friends...
He's dressed as an Olympic swimmer, so it's fine.
He's gonna dive off the crow's nest.
Double back, double front flip.
Tens across the board.
That's more disturbing because who's giving him the tens?
Ten knives. As Madison Washington and his friends self-emancipated and liberated the other prisoners, these three assholes were just hanging from ropes suspended in midair.
Thank God.
Like, the whole time?
Eventually, they came down and submitted to being imprisoned by the recently freed people.
Yeah, if you don't come down here, we'll make you come down here, and you won't like it.
I mean, I would just be like, Well, you're welcome to stay up there, but eventually your hands are going to get tired.
Yeah.
So start cutting the ropes from the bottom.
Yeah, you need those ropes.
Yeah, true, but maybe they didn't know that.
So like the Amistad captives, the owners of the Creole demanded that one of the white slavers act as a navigator and take them to Africa. In this case, they wanted to go to Liberia, the American colony set up to give a place to free black people so that they could, well, so that they could go to Africa and set up their own violent colonialist caste system. But it was framed as a good idea at the time.
That's like the only other country that has an American president as their capital, right? Monrovia?
Yes, Monrovia. Mm-hmm. The white navigator was like, you know, I'd love to do all of that, but do you have any idea how far away Africa is? We do not have food or water supplies on board to make that kind of journey. You know, because our ship was full of people instead. We can't do that. Everyone on board will die.
I mean, fair.
Yeah, this was not a lie. They did not have the resources to go to fucking Liberia. And even though Liberia was an abolitionist project, it was a U.S. colony. They probably would have been sent back. The white slavers would have had more luck getting compensation or some kind of agreement from the government if they could go there. Now, with my knowledge of history, if I were one of these guys trying to find a safe haven for self-emancipated black people fleeing the United States, that's a bit closer than Africa, my first thought would be Haiti, which was still a relatively stable country at this point, despite lots of foreign fuckery.
Yeah.
So it is probably a testament to the success of American slavers in suppressing the story of Haitian independence that nobody suggested that as an option.
Oh yeah. I heard that story wasn't even like there was so, everyone was so terrified in America of a revolution that they were just like, okay, no one say anything. No one's allowed to know anything.
Part of the reason Americans don't remember Haiti as much today is because we deliberately scrubbed it from our institutional memory at the time that it was happening. Haiti and Liberia will both get their due on this show at some point. But for now, the free people of the Creole were fortunate that Madison Washington wasn't the only black person on board who followed the news. Another of the mutineers, named Ben Blacksmith, remembered a story from the previous year. A much smaller slave ship called the Hermosa had been sailing from Richmond to New Orleans when it was wrecked in a storm and ultimately ran aground in the Bahamas, a British colony. Since the British had abolished slavery and were actively feuding with the U.S., the Hermosa's captives were set free by the colonial government. Ben Blacksmith suggested that they go to the Bahamas, possibly just relieved that it wasn't an impossible journey across the Atlantic or a country whose revolution had famously massacred white slavers. The navigator agreed to this plan and set out for Nassau.
Yeah, self-preservation here.
Yeah, you know, like, all right, that's a fair deal. We'll go to the British.
All right, we got three options. All right, we're going to either go to America, Haiti, or the Bahamas.
Yeah. Honestly, given that list, I'd go with this option now. Once they were in the Bahamas, the British governor announced that most of the captives were free to disembark and go wherever they pleased. They were considered completely free and independent people under British law. Given that Nassau wasn't a very big place and that over 100 extra people was a lot to absorb at once,
yeah.
They also arranged for as many as wanted it to move to Jamaica, and a lot of the newly freed people took them up on that offer. Madison Washington, Ben Blacksmith, and the other men who actually carried out the revolt were arrested and held in prison for a trial. There wasn't really any doubt that the British, or by the British, for how that would turn out, but it was a legal formality that had to be covered. Two of the mutineers unfortunately died in custody from the wounds they sustained during the mutiny.
Ooh, they went, they lasted a while, their injuries. That's unfortunate.
It is fast enough that I don't think they would have been saved by having free access to medical coverage, and right. Possibly they might have lasted longer because they had some kind of government oversight.
Yeah.
It's also the 1830s, and we haven't done germ theory yet.
It's in the background, kind of festering though.
Yeah, festering like cholera. In court, these mutineers were considered free people under British law, and therefore they had the right to escape illegal bondage by the use of whatever force was necessary. Five people, either heavily traumatized or desperate to reunite with someone back home, voluntarily remained on the Creole and were sent back into enslavement in the United States.
Wow.
In total, 128 people were freed for life by the Creole mutineers, making it possibly the single most successful slave revolt in United States history.
Ow. That's sad. That's terribly sad.
Yeah, for an institution of millions, 128 is the highest number who were able to rebel successfully.
That's crazy.
Like, it is, like, I know it shouldn't be because of, like, the limited resources they have in most scenarios in history, but the fact that, like, just slavery revolts in general have such bad turnouts every time, and if they do have a good turnout, over time, that turns out to be terrible, or it's just so small it doesn't matter.
Yeah, it's because in a system where you rely on enslaving people, it's not even that they have little access to resource. I mean, look at what these guys did with a knife. It's that the government around them puts incredible amounts of its own resources into suppressing rebellion.
Yeah.
The Creole mutineers, especially Madison Washington, became heroes of the American abolitionist cause. Frederick Douglass, probably the most famous black abolitionist, even wrote a novella about Madison called The Heroic Slave.
Yeah.
The Creole was actually the third slave ship mutiny still in open dispute between the U.S. and Britain in the Caribbean. Another ship, the Enterprise, was blown off course in 1835 and had to land in Bermuda, where the captives on board were both liberated and found in British courts to mostly be free black people from Maryland who had been kidnapped and illegally sold to begin with.
Except you, Jeff. You're going back to America.
Here's the obligatory Star Trek joke for my dad and my dad alone. That was the joke. said the Enterprise. That was it. Yeah.
Right. All right.
Acknowledging that it was called the Enterprise. That's all I got.
The kidnapping and illegal sale of human beings within the United States is its own series of issues that goes way beyond what I want to cover today, which is why I'm mostly skipping past the Enterprise. But it is worth noting that these three cases were open in 1842. Two other ships, the Comet and the Encomium, had wrecked in the Bahamas with similar results about a decade earlier, and Britain had already paid indemnities for the cost of the human beings they liberated.
Okay.
So there were three cases of self-emancipation by way of becoming British open in contention during the negotiations. The U.S. wasn't directly threatening military action over these cases in the same way as the Northern Border dispute. After all, this was well-publicized British policy that had been in effect for decades. However, the relatively large number of incidents in such a short amount of time was a major contributing factor to widespread American support for war against Britain in general.
Yeah.
As military tensions heated up in the North, the slavers of the Southern U.S. were more than happy to throw their support behind the war hawks because war, or even just negotiations, could help secure more favorable conditions for the slave trade. So put all of the last three episodes in context when I talk about how there was all of this popular support in the U.S. for the Aroostook War or for the Canadian Patriots. Part of that popular support is because the South is trying to start a war with Britain.
Yeah.
That makes a lot more sense.
Yeah.
And also the South knows that Britain can't be seen allying with them because they're everything they're talking against right now. So why not convince the rest of our country to go after them first?
Yeah, it's because slavery is still a Spanish institution, they really want to do something to push the U.S. and Spain closer together.
Yeah.
The Southern politicians are all angling against Britain at this time for a bunch of reasons, and they're using Canada as a proxy. Daniel Webster, the U.S. negotiator, recognized that British law required freeing any enslaved person who entered their territory. But he wanted Lord Ashburton to agree to pay the U.S. for their lost human chattel. Ashburton was not authorized to deal with this, but he was authorized to make some progress on American-British relations over slavery. Things were then complicated by the new president, Zachary Taylor's position on the issue. With the Creole case actively in the news, Taylor wanted immediate redress to come out of the Webster-Ashburton process. Writing about the American president, Lord Ashburton said, "He is very sore and testy about the Creole."
Oh.
Then in a letter to another of the British legal team, he wrote, "My great plague was the Creole, and you will see how I have at last disposed of it.
Oh.
At least a dozen various attempts at explanation, with a capital E, were tried, and there came only yesterday a garrulous, foolish letter from the president to Webster, which made me fear we might at last stick fast. And if it were not that general object of the mission in the country, I think this would have been the case. My settlement on this point was at last sulkily received by him. How it may be considered by you remains to be seen. I have only to beg you recollect that it was a case attended with no inconsiderable difficulty."
Yeah.
So the British negotiator is just writing letters complaining about the United States president back to the Home Office.
Well, has anything changed?
And that was a big thing with Taylor as well, is because he was a relatively nobody in Washington before he got elected, and he never made a stance on slavery. And so a lot of people were like, well, which way is he going to go, right? Like, he owns slaves, but he seems very absentee slave owner, and he hasn't made any remarks negative or positive about it.
Well, this is kind of part of his coming out on where he fell on that.
Definitely.
Partially by promising that future negotiations would address the Creole, Hermosa, and Enterprise, Ashburton was able to pressure Webster into agreeing to a U.S. commitment to enforce an end to the international slave trade.
Right.
The U.S. Navy's West African Squadron was required by treaty to dedicate a minimum number of ships and man hours to patrolling for illegal slavers. However, President Taylor viciously refused to allow either side to inspect ships sailing under one another's flag, meaning that an illegal cargo ship just had to carry a copy of the Stars and Stripes and the Union Jack, then just fly whichever one of them was necessary to evade the nearest vessel.
Great.
The odds of running into ships from both the U.S. and the U.K. at the same time were just astronomically low.
The ocean's a big place.
Yeah, there's even the Atlantic, which when you look at it, is kind of a small ocean, is a big fucking ocean.
Oh, yeah. You could fit Europe in there twice.
Yeah.
More than that.
Yeah, you could fit so many Europes. Ultimately, negotiations on the issue of slavery went basically nowhere. But negotiations about the Caroline incident from our last episode actually gave Lord Ashburton a way out. By making mutiny on the high seas one of the crimes worthy of extradition in the Caroline negotiation, the British found an angle on slavery to appease the Americans. In Ashburton's own words, "If the Americans must send cargo along the coast, why not give it convoy by one of their own vessels? We shall certainly do nothing to encourage mutiny either among slaves or freemen. But if the slaves bring a vessel into an English port, I do not see how we can again consign them to slavery. However, we might be disposed to deal with them as mutineers." And that is why 19 men from the Creole were held prisoner by the British for a few months. By giving them a trial for mutiny, the British were abiding by the treaty conditions. It just so happened that under British law, it is basically impossible to find someone enslaved guilty of that crime. But in the moment, it was enough to appease Zachary Tyler. Ironically, the president's hyperfixation on the Creole may actually have helped the United States get a more favorable settlement in the Aroostook boundary dispute, too. In another letter, Ashburton wrote, "The president, as a Virginian, has a strong opinion that the Creole case, and is not little disposed to be obstinate on the subject. In the Senate, all the South will be on the same side, and if my boundary treaty were not strongly supported by Maine as the party interested, the South might give me trouble and endeavor to keep open the quarrel." Basically, the British had to give Maine more land than they wanted if the Northern Americans weren't happy.
Oh.
Or if the Southerners had enough leverage to keep pushing for conflict between the U.S. and Britain, which they thought would benefit the American slave trade, things could have gone a very different way, so they ceded territory in the North.
Wow.
Oh.
In the end, specific negotiations over the Creole went nowhere, but they did inadvertently cause some worthwhile compromises in other parts of the treaty. Ultimately, the Creole and other slave ships would remain open issues of contention, alongside other financial issues that Webster and Ashburton couldn't agree on, for another decade. But that will be part of our next and final episode in this series.
Ooh.
Right now, I just want to know, what are your thoughts on this whole ugly mess?
Like, it sucks, because obviously slavery sucks. But it also, like, I appreciate the context in which, like, all of these, like, seemingly silly, like, why are we taking these disputes so seriously when they're really over, like, nothing at the end of the day? Like, it really cements, they did not exist in a vacuum. And regrettably, it all comes down to how America sucks, as it always does.
Well, and also, too, like, when you learn about American history and you learn about American slavery, it's often... And not that this is a bad thing, but it's often always stated as the South is bad and this is all the bad things that they've done. But and you never really hear these kind of small, even if they're like relatively small and only a little bit successful, these moments that have in some ways paved the way to eventually 1865, right?
Oh, absolutely. The role of enslaved people in abolishing slavery is so fucking understated in this country.
Yeah.
It's almost like if they never fought, well, what would the world look like now? At least, especially America.
Yeah, it is ridiculous that, like, we don't talk about slave revolts. We don't talk about maroon communities of people who freed themselves and hid out in the South. We don't talk about the internal uprisings against the Confederacy during the Civil War.
Which is such a shame, because this history is so rich and interesting. Like, even if we're not taking over, like, the moral responsibility, if you want to call it, to learn the history that you benefit from as people in the United States, like, it's just, it's interesting, and it should be learned about.
Right. Every single person you come across on the abolitionist side has a fascinating life. All of the slave owners, like, my dad owned a plantation. But like,
it's like
Madison Washington and Tsing Bei Pia and John Quincy Adams and, you know, John Brown, like everybody, Harriet Tubman, everyone's fucking interesting.
Well, even like, think about how many black people you could name before 1980 in American history. right? It's so small. Frederick Douglass, Harry Tubman, you know, then you jump forward 100 years to like King and Malcolm X, right? Like you really don't hear anything about them.
No, it's so just buried. Nat Turner is the other one that people might know about in terms of like Black resistance.
Well, one of my favorite is one of the first Congress members in American history, John Mercer Langston. And I never even heard about him until relatively recently. And he had a massive impact on relations between the Emancipation Proclamation and everything. Like he was a massive part of Black history and American history, but no one knows about it.
Yeah, it's insane how people get lost in the, you know, the grand political struggle about them. Like,
yeah,
talking about abolition in the U.S. and only talking about Black people with a couple of or examples would be like talking about the Holocaust and not talking about the Jews. Yeah. Like, yeah. It's completely insane.
And like, it's such like, I obviously we know, but like, it's simply erasure. Like it's when we're talking about the creation of the United States, it's such like a pivotal point. And when like you talk to anyone outside of the United States, it's something that is so well known, like in their history, but within the United States, it's like, we're taking out the history that was given to these people and we're still taking that away. You're like, no, you can't even have that.
Yeah, and it's all well and good to champion the white abolitionists, right? Like, yes, John Quincy Adams, the great things. And all of these guys during like Abraham Lincoln and all of those people during the Civil War that were supporting Black people when a lot of people in the country said not to, they should be remembered, but they shouldn't be the first ones you think of.
Yeah.
God, I hate that this ties so directly back to current fucking events, but like, and you can go online and just follow the news, you know, mainstream, but not bending over backwards. This shit is happening in real time. Like, we are watching the National Park Service purge references to things on their websites because it's diverse.
Like, it's just watching this as like a third party. Like, of course, we're inextricably linked to the United States, but watching it happen, there's this energy in Canada where it's like you're watching, well, topical, a plane crash. And there's nothing you can do to stop it. Like, it's just happening right in front of your eyes. And you're like, how are we here? How did we get here?
And also, like, that motion, I believe I saw it written down, that, like, they're thinking of getting rid of certain days for the year. Or, like, for example, maybe let's get rid of Black History Month and Pride Month and...
Oh, they're all just fucking gone.
Indigenous, yeah, National Indigenous Month or whatever. Like, there's so many things that are still here and they're seen as a good thing, a good representation, but they're just leaving in the country that they should all be in the most.
Yeah, it is an intention. It is a purge. It's a political purge. Yeah. Like, yeah.
I saw someone saying it's a whiting out of history.
Yeah. I don't know. I'd call it a digital book burning.
Right.
Yeah.
All right. But yeah, America is fucked. Slavery was and will in the future again be fucked. And Totalus Jeffianus, tell the people where they can find you on the internet.
All right, Nick.
I literally made like a cute little hand gesture for you to go. And all right. Well, you can find us on Podbean, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, anywhere you get your podcasts. We are at Totalus Jeffianus we're not. We're only at Jeffianus on Blue Sky. We are off of X.
Yeah, we deleted X. You can no longer find our podcast on X. So it was a hard, not really, decision. but one that we're ever grateful for.
Yeah. But that's us.
All right.
Yippee.
If for some reason you want to hear more of my voice, you can listen to History of Persia, where I cover the history of ancient Iran from 700 BC to 700 CE. If you want to support either of these projects, you can go to hopfulmedia.com.co and subscribe, donate, or buy some merchandise. And you can find me on social media at History of Persia on Blue Sky, History of Persia podcast on Meta until I delete those. And if you find me on X, I'll ignore you because I'm just there to watch it burn.
can I just say that it was your podcast, History of Persia, that really, like, as long with like History of Byzantium and History of Rome, that really got me into history and really got me into wanting to do.
Oh, well, thank you so much.
He was literally so excited that you talked to us. He'll be embarrassed that I mentioned that, but he literally came to me. He's like, oh my God, Trevor messaged me.
It was the same thing about meeting Bree for the first time in person. It was just felt weird when all you do is hear these people and they kind of built these bigger, like, you know, foundations as they've grown. And, you know, it feels good to have joined it and be welcomed.
You know, that's how I feel like when I interact with Wesley from History of the Great War on Discord, definitely. Or like when I was on a panel with Robin Pearson for Intelligent Speech, and I was like, I'm lying to Robin Pearson about the meaning of the word home gang, like. All right. And before signing off, rate this podcast on whatever platform you listen on. Apple is the one that anybody actually cares about. Leave a rating, leave a review, say nice things about me, please. Especially for a podcast like this, people are going to be chuds and leave shitty reviews because they disagree with me. Go leave a nice review.
Your hair is really nice.
Thank you. Yeah, you, the listener who can't see it, say that. I don't care what you say. Just put 5 stars. Until next time, punch a Nazi.
Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East, the very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.
The history of Persia is intertwined with conquest. It began with conquest when Cyrus, king of a small city called Anshan, set out to build the greatest empire the world had ever seen. In a series of stunning campaigns, he achieved just that, becoming one of the greatest conquerors in history and basically started Persian history. After all, you don't get the title the Great for nothing. But he wouldn't be the last great Persian conqueror. Other Persian rulers like Darius the Great, Mithridates I, and Ardashir I would go on to become great conquerors on their own, establishing their own great empires and legacies. If you want to hear their story, and the stories of other great conquerors, many of whom are far less famous despite their great achievements, join me, Ramzi Shalah, on my podcast, The Conquerors Podcast, available on all platforms you listen through.